The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, What Can We Do About Politics, was recorded at The Guardian in April 2015 and was chaired by author and Guardian columnist Zoe Williams.
Hi everybody, thanks for coming tonight. We're having a conversation which isn't really about the election, which I think is one of its main positives. I mean, obviously we're going to talk about the election by accident, but the topic is much more what's possible in politics that you wouldn't articulate through which party you're going to vote for. I'm going to name the organisation of everybody on the panel, but they're going to tell you exactly what it is that they do. I'm also going to tell you what political question I think they answer, or what kind of area I think they answer, but they might disagree with that almost as soon as I've said it. So this is David Babbs. He's head of 38 Degrees. I think it answers a question of engagement and democracy and within kind of what you can use the internet for and what you can... how you can kind of build networks, but you might not agree with that.
I like that.
OK. Yep. This is Cara Sofoco, who is head of Europe. Is
that...
She's not head of Europe. She works for an organisation called Some of Us, which is about shareholder activism, but that makes it sound like only rich people do it, and that's actually not true. This is Fran Bowie, who runs Positive Money, and this answers really, really wide-ranging, quite complicated questions about money creation and through that, housing and the future and the environment and society. Is that fair?
Sure, I'll
that. This is Julia Groves, who runs the Trillium Fund, which is, on paper, it crowdfunds for renewable energy projects, but it does much more than that, I think. Is that fair? Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of environmental slant on a financialization kind of issue. And this is Brian May, who you will all know. But he runs the Common Decency Campaign, which I think answers a lot of questions about how you're supposed to interact with politics if you don't like the look of any of them. Is that fair?
That's quite a good summary, yes.
Okay, good. Excellent. So describe the work you do in as long or as short as you like, because I know none of you are going to go mad.
Do you want me to start?
Okay.
So I guess there are a few underlying assumptions to 38 Degrees. Firstly, that democracy works better if more people get involved, but politics is too important to leave to narrow elites, to politicians. A second assumption that it's a very convenient explanation for non-participation to talk about apathy if you're a member of a political class, but actually there are all kinds of other much better and more compelling reasons why people don't get involved in conventional politics. And actually, most people aren't apathetic. They care about the decisions that affect them, the future of UK society, our role in the world. And that kind of led on to a third assumption we had when we started 38 Degrees, which was that if you start giving people meaningful ways of getting involved in questions of a political nature, where they feel a sense of agency, where they feel like their views are listened to, that they're not taken for granted, they will get involved. And I guess the growth of 38 Degrees over the last 5 years has kind of demonstrated that theory was right, that people do want to get involved. And we've now got over 3 million people involved in 38 Degrees in that way. So at its heart, what we're trying to do is help people who aren't members of a political class to experience their power, to feel able to get involved, to want to get involved, and to to feel powerful through getting involved because what they've done has made a difference, which, you know, builds a movement, builds a network of people who work together to pool their resources, pool their ideas, their influence as voters, their cash on occasion, to bring those things together through a kind of new 21st century form of collective action that can influence political decision making.
Brilliant.
Would that do?
Yeah, no, I love it.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Fantastic.
I thought we were going to be tightly timed, so I'd written a few things down, but I'll feel free to freestyle.
I can just shout at you.
Okay, so has anyone heard of Some of Us?
I have. I'll
give a little wave, other than Zoe. Okay, so we're a global movement of consumers, workers and investors, and we work to hold big corporations accountable. In some ways, we're running a very similar model to 38 Degrees. We didn't exist 3.5 years ago. Now there are 5 million of us worldwide. About 1 million people are members in the UK, so receive our emails and take actions. And so I said consumers, workers and investors, just to give you a quick flavour of the kind of things we do. So we mobilise... So big companies have too much power. That influences our democracy, our society, our economy. But the trick or the secret that Some of Us is founded on is that we work for them, we own them, and we buy their products, which means that they can exist. So Some of Us has got a pretty simple mission, which is to mobilise our power as consumers. So we run brand damaging campaigns. A recent one is we've been targeting PepsiCo about their use of palm oil, unsustainable palm oil. If you want to know more about that, Google Doritos, a cheesy love story. We mobilise shareholders. So we've just got through a resolution at Amazon's AGM, asking the board to mandate for Amazon to do a human rights audit, given its pretty shameful workplace practices. And we mobilised, what's the third one, workers. So a couple of years ago, we helped some window manufacturers in Chicago buy out their factory when the owners were planning to scrap it, and now it's a workers' cooperative. Yeah, so that's what we do. And I guess I'm here because, I mean, partly because I left Westminster to go and work for Some of Us a couple of months ago, and also because we can mobilise our power as economic citizens as well. A lot of the problems with our political system are perpetuated or caused by politicians, but they are actually, some of them aren't, and we need to take action to tackle those as well.
Great. Lovely. Fran?
So has anyone heard of Positive Money? Okay, a few people. So we are a research and campaigning organisation challenging basically the money and banking system. And we were set up after the financial crash, basically because no one was talking about money creation and specifically how it's created. So most people don't know this, including most politicians, economists, etc. But money is created out of nothing when commercial banks make loans. And they make the vast majority, over 80% of loans, to property and financial markets, which kind of skews our economy to housing bubbles, the City of London, and we all end up under a mountain of debt, because for every £1 they create, there's a pound of debt attached. And so really, I guess I've been invited here because we're a kind of a movement driven by people. We've got now over 25,000 people in the UK, and around 30 local groups across the UK actually getting together and talking about monetary policy, which is pretty crazy. But we also have about 20 other groups that have popped up in other countries, which are also getting together and organised on this issue. And we're part of a kind of wider movement called the Transforming Finance Network, which is a whole load of NGOs which are trying to challenge the financial system. And, you know, one thing about this election is that, you know, the two main parties, financial reform is basically off the agenda. But we know, you know, from our work and lots of people's work, that the banking system isn't fixed. We've still got a really broken system and potentially heading for another financial crash. So a big part of our work is empowering people in a subject which most people feel they don't have voice, which is the banking system, and saying it doesn't have to be like this. We designed it. We could do it differently.
Great. Julia.
So we created Trillion Fund originally to try and get as many people as possible to move their money out of the dirty stuff into the clean stuff, so to divest from companies that were perpetuating issues about where energy comes from and put it into clean energy. It was called Trillion originally because we needed to invest that amount of money to avoid the planet going 2 degrees hotter than it is now. Interestingly, this year, for the first time, the amount of money held in savings and ISAs in the UK below the rate of inflation has also just hit £1 trillion. And you've got to think there might be a better use for that money than propping up banks, getting out into the real economy. But also it's about this weird existence where we've all become very scared of our money, where we delegate responsibility for it. And we think a lot of that is because people can't see where the money is and what it's doing. It's a damn shame to work hard and pay tax and then pay what we used to call in Northern Ireland, pass the bomb. You have a game here called pass the parcel, I understand. Ours is called pass the bomb. Goes rather more quickly than your game. And under each layer, there's a forfeit. And the idea is as soon as you get the parcel, you want to get rid of it as quickly as possible. So I'm not quite sure how this happened, that we don't know where our money is and we don't feel like we can make decisions about it. And we campaigned for the last 2 years, for example, with the Financial Conduct Authority, a campaign called Wealth is Not a Skill Set, because what I'm doing is crowdfunding. And the rules used to be you could only do crowdfunding if you're a high net worth individual or a sophisticated investor. Oh, and you have to invest at least £1,000. So we tried to explain that the clue is in the title, crowdfunding, and that minimum investments of £1,000 really wasn't what we were looking for. So we're trying to democratise finance, and in doing so, decentralise energy. We're really worried about where energy is coming from, and the only way you're going to get low energy prices is to put some more competition in the market. So it's a fairly disruptive play. We aim to get £1 billion by 2020 into projects which support the triple bottom line of people, planet and profit.
Lovely.
Wow.
So come on.
Brian.
Move your money.
Well, our campaign is called Common Decency, and it was born out of our experiences over the last 5 years, lobbying, campaigning to give animals a voice. That's where we come from. I started a campaign called Save Me about 6 years ago when I realised that Cameron was about to try to bring back fox hunting, which I thought was unbelievably barbaric, and I couldn't believe that that this was about to happen. It almost happened, in point of fact. I mean, Cameron did get in, but not with a clear majority, so his promised free vote on fox hunting never happened. What happened is we spent the last 5 years basically beating our heads against a wall. We've had all sorts of parties. I mean, we've been talking about trying to stop the Hunting Act being repealed and also trying to stop them culling badgers pointlessly, because it's been shown by all the scientists in the field that culling badgers actually makes TB worse for farmers. Nevertheless, the government ploughs on with this. So we've been fighting those two major issues and getting pretty much nowhere. In spite of huge marches, in spite of getting 300,000 people to sign a petition on the government's own website, which gave us a debate in the House of Commons, which gave us a vote, which we won, and we thought, hey, democracy works. And of course, what happens? Nothing happens. The government kind of smirked at us and said, oh, yeah, you won the debate, but it's not an important debate, and we're going to do exactly what we were doing before. So to cut a long story short, my CEO, Anne, and myself decided that the only way we were going to succeed instead of banging our heads against this wall was to try and knock the wall down. So that means a lot more than getting rid of the government that's been in place for the last 5 years, which I think is a given. It means shaking up the system which allowed them to get into that position of effectively being despots. You know, it is a kind of a serial dictatorship, because really nothing that anybody says makes any difference. I'm extrapolating a lot, because I was talking about animals before, now I'm talking about everything, but it's because of my experiences recently meeting people like the NHA party, who have had a very parallel experience to our own. They keep banging and banging and saying, look, you're selling off the national health, you're giving it to people to make a profit out of. And the government go, no, we're not. And so they're banging their heads up against the same wall that we are, and in a sense that there's been a lot of other confirmations of that. So common decency was born out of a desire to change that. How on earth could you change that? It's a response to people saying, apart from my own passions, it's a response to people saying, why should I vote? How can my vote possibly make any difference? I live in a safe seat. Whether I vote or not, it doesn't matter. It's going to make no difference. So can I have one minute on pie charts? One minute of pie charts.
Whoa, pie charts.
I love my pie chart. Yeah, pie charts. Yeah, I just love pictures. I used to teach maths. This is a constituency last year, 2010. This is the guy who won. He's got 37% of the electorate in his area. And they call it a safe seat because obviously he's way ahead of these other two guys. So what's the point if you're a Liberal Democrat or a Labour Party member of voting here? You could just stay at home. My point is, look at this. This part is all the people who didn't vote. That's a very powerful place. And my hope is that if you could inspire all these people, number one, to vote, but number two, to vote according to some plan, then they can get behind this guy or this guy or even this guy, and they can get this guy out. That means that if you follow the scheme that I'm proposing, no vote is wasted and no seat is safe. That's the plan.
It's a good plan. It's a sound plan.
But it's why they say there's no point in campaigning in a youth club. You might as well go to an old people's home, you know, because old people will vote and the kids won't. Ha ha. Yeah. So it's so important. Nobody, you know,
I've been to a lot of universities talking about this, and they really get it, and it's great. Yeah, it's lovely to see that.
I mean, I think this kind of apathetic youth vote is a complete myth. But anyway,
David said they're not. I couldn't agree more. People are not apathetic on the whole, but they're just disempowered and disenchanted and fed up with the system.
So but I just because they're fed up doesn't mean they vote. So I'm not saying they're apathetic. No. I'm just saying that, you know.
No, so you have to do this.
I know that there appears on the panel to be a bit of a tilt towards kind of money and kind of banking and finance. And the reason, in a way, I did that is because I feel like watching conventional politics, the things that the areas they're most scared of are they don't ever think they can challenge business, they don't ever think they can challenge finance, and they don't ever think they can challenge the energy markets. And if you can't challenge those things, then other things like housing and wages and animal rights and everything else become really difficult because you've got these kind of... Does anybody, I mean, in no particular order, Fran, do you think politics is bust or do you think there are still things they can do?
I'm an optimist, so, I mean, you know, we can make change if we get more and more people active. But, I mean, in terms of, you know, we did a poll last July because our hypothesis that was that politicians didn't know that banks create money out of nothing. So we polled 100 MPs, or someone did it for us, and 70% of them think that the sole issuer of money is the Bank of England. There is a real lack of understanding. We don't expect politicians to understand everything, but because of the way the system works, we do. And actually, if you go and then tell them that they don't understand anything, obviously they're going to get a bit defensive about it. And so we then did a backbench debate off the back of that. And actually, we, through our supporter base, managed to get 40 MPs to turn up and talk about money creation, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, when you look at how many turn up to a food bank debate,
it's
like two.
Yeah, and even the ones that some turn up and didn't speak, and they told us, you know, we don't feel confident because we don't understand the system. And so, I don't know, I feel like part of it is just getting a conversation out there. But I guess a big part of this is also the fact that economics is kind of broken. I mean, I didn't study economics, but the way it's taught is producing economists which have an understanding of the system which is completely flawed, and we hold these people up to be like the high priests of how we should run our economy.
But what politics can't fix is things which go beyond their cycles, and that's why energy and climate change is such a massive issue. Is it just a global issue, but you can't change it in the 2.5 years you've got between you running for election, getting voted and getting in. So I think that's one of the real challenges, is we need to create more patient capital that will invest with a longer term, because public companies have to produce quarterly results and grow the whole time because they think that's what the shareholders want. Fascinated, I hadn't even heard of some of us. I'm like, it's nuts. But because you know, you don't have to sell 100% of the shares to impact the market cap to drive a change, surely.
No. I can talk. I was going to jump in on banks, but I can talk.
Jump in on banks and then tell me what a market cap is.
Yeah, sure, that'll be fine. There is another thing, right, which is that the reason politicians don't wade into banks is that big banks do have bigger balance sheets than our GDP. It's even a brave politician that wanted to take on the banks, like that these companies can cripple our economy and have done so. We've been trying to do some work around HSBC. I'm guessing everyone's familiar with the latest scandal. But we're a global organisation, so you know, we've sort of been tracking the various different things they've been doing in different countries. And, you know, in the US, there were regulators that seemed to want to try and break up the bank. And from our understanding is that they were told in no uncertain terms, if they did that, there would be severe economic consequences. Mm. So I think we have to give politicians a bit of a break here in that some of these, it's just really hard. And so it's easier to talk about housing or,
although it's very difficult to talk about housing if you aren't prepared to talk about money creation, because, as long as you're going to extend credit lines that inflate the housing market.
But it's the whole kind of powerless apathy thing just does my head in.
Either
move your money and make some decisions or shut up, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, the apathy is, I understand why things are difficult, but, we do own our shares in the companies and we do elect the politicians. So I do think that it's just that you kind of don't know where to start. And you look at the politicians and go, they're not for me. We don't believe the brands anymore and we don't believe the banks anymore. And therefore, that's what's so isolating, and you feel like nothing you're going to do is going to make a difference.
Can I?
I'm very naive as regards the money stuff. Could I ask you a question? Which is, we bailed out the banks some time ago with our money. It wasn't the government that bailed them out, it was us. And normally if you bailed a failing company out, you would take some shares in that company. How come we don't own any part of the banks? How come we don't have shares in?
We own the majority of RBS and we are selling off our shares in Lloyds, so we won't own. I mean, the issue is that the government won't be an active shareholder in the banks. We just basically sort of sit back and say, yeah, carry on as you were. But we actually had, we had the power to impose bonus caps on NatWest and RBS if we'd wanted.
And why won't politicians go? Why won't they take ownership of
the ownership there as well?
Yeah.
The government can't be seen to if their whole plan is to make sure they sell it off as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. There's this whole, they can't be seen to interfere in something that they shouldn't be interfering in. It's this fear of the financial sector and the markets and how the markets would respond if any politicians said, that they do anything. I mean, there is a lot of paranoia as well, I think MPs have over how much the markets will respond to things they say. Yeah, I've talked to MPs who said, if I went on Newsnight and talked about money creation, the markets would respond. And it's kind of I don't think they would, actually.
The markets.
Ooh.
I don't think anyone really knows. I mean, I worked at the Economics Foundation, so Fran and I worked together. When people say the markets, I don't think anyone even knows which markets would do what. I think it's they're going to pack up and leave. Yeah. The rich people will leave if we tax them or do anything.
Basically, they think they won't buy government bonds anymore, which isn't true.
David, I was going to... Fraser Nelson said this quite interesting thing, which is that in politics, the rule is, if it can't be fixed, it ain't broken. And that is something that actually, 38 degrees has really blown a hole in, because you do take on a lot of things which, according to normal politics, can't be fixed. Mm. Tell me more about that.
I think politics is quite broken.
Yeah.
So quite a lot is written and it's often discussed, the public's declining level of trust and faith in politicians. I think what's less discussed is I see a parallel decline in politicians' faith and trust in voters. So you've got this kind of widening chasm on both sides. I often encounter, well, frankly not too often, but when I kind of go into Parliament to represent the views of 38 Degrees members, try and gather intelligence to help inform 38 Degrees campaigns, I regularly encounter a kind of level of contempt and bitterness and resentment about the way that voters feel about the political class, about the temerity that people have to get in touch with their MP and ask them how they're going to vote on something. Mm. There's real antagonism on both sides there, which you'd think would lead to a or just a huge sense of feeling very hard done by over the MP expenses scandal. We're underpaid and misunderstood, and you worked for an MP until quite recently and you're nodding. I think the interesting question, though, is how remarkable where that goes, because I think at exactly the same time the system is remarkably resilient and stable in some ways. How few people can believe in the system, can vote for the governing party before it actually ceases to function properly. There's a real kind of paradox there. The British constitution is designed to kind of yield stability despite with very few people actually feeling happy with what is stable.
That sounds really sad.
It is, but I completely disagree.
Okay.
Because I've been, and again, I'm on the naive spectrum, so maybe we're the naive corner. But I've been staggered by how accessible everything is and the change you've been able to create in 2 years. I'm completely blown away. And you know, we've walked into the middle of financial services.
Yeah.
And we've completely changed all the regulations so everyone can participate. And we've taken away the rules which said you can only do this if you're rich. Mm-hmm. I can get a meeting with absolutely anybody I want to, and we're definitely driving change. And I think the secret is, you know, I'm now obsessed with some of us having heard 3 minutes about it. But the difference is, right, so I did BritishAirways.com in 94. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about BA.com was the fact that the technology disintermediated, right? And we used to have this thing called differential pricing, where we charge a different amount of money for your ticket according to where you bought it. You've heard me say this. So if you were in Hong Kong and you buy a ticket for a child in London, that's because Harry's at public school, isn't it? So we add a note onto the price of the ticket, haha, because we know you're in Hong Kong and Harry's at Eton. Job done. So differential pricing used to get called the mug factor in the airline. It was worth £300 million a year. Mm. And it disappeared in 18 months because on the internet, all the prices were in the same place at the same time. Now, I love that. I love the fact that the transparency puts the power back in the hands of the consumer. So that was, I was already excited in 1994. Then roll on 2014, right? And suddenly it's not just about one consumer dealing with one brand. In fact, mm-hmm. I think the term consumer is going to be wiped out. All the forward-thinking brands will not think about their customers as consumers of what they made. It's got to be much more partnerial. But the difference with Web 2.0 is we all connect together. So here we come. They better watch out. Because when we all put ourselves together, whether it's a Groupon to get a better price or whether it's crowdfunding things, that is where the energy comes from. The politicians just are not going to do it. I've given up waking up thinking, one day the politicians are going to make the world better. We just need to get off our backsides and do it ourselves, but we do need other people to do it with.
So in a way, that was my next question. Do you think? Do you kind of look at the system, because a second ago you were saying they were really, really accessible, and now you're saying... But now you're saying they're basically irrelevant.
No. Okay, so...
Well, that's fine.
They're not
going to be accessible and irrelevant.
They are there for us to use, okay? We vote them in and we buy the products and we invest our money and we are underestimating the influence that we have. But I don't think... You know, I'm fairly ballsy and optimistic and mouthy and relentless and a pain in the ass. But even I, as we discussed... hide under the table crying sometimes, and it'd be great if somebody sees me under the table, if you could come and try and get me out and give me a biscuit or something, I'll probably be fine afterwards. You can't do it by yourself every day again and again and again relentlessly, because the system wears you down, and that's what they're counting on.
And I didn't want to sound defeatist
at all.
I think it my sense is that there is a way of disrupting that and challenging that, and it is about, to use a quite old-fashioned phrase, it's about collective action. I think at its heart, campaigning, unless you're Rupert Murdoch or the British Bankers Association or someone with a lot of intrinsic power as an individual institution, then campaigning is a kind of asymmetric battle. You're challenging other institutions that probably have more power than any one of us in this room does as an individual. So what you're thinking? I think campaigning is about finding ways that we can come together, can coordinate, and pool our resources, pool our power in order to wage those changes. And I think that that's not to say that an individual with kind of an entrepreneurial spirit can't make interventions that change things. But I think when you kind of come up against that kind of hard power at the heart of the kind of intersection of big business and big government, you do have to have quite a lot of force to change things. And, you know, we have seen examples of that working over the last few years. I mean, you know, 38 Degrees has kept some hospitals open. We've shifted some things in ways that I don't think any one of the people involved in the campaign could have done that on their own. But I think at the same time, it is important we're realistic about like the scale of the challenge and how many people it needs to be coming together.
Brian, I wanted to ask you actually about...
Well, can I just say, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to do this? All of us, all of what we're saying, because we're all sort of fighting against this. Wouldn't it? It's a serious point because really, I think we're all fighting a system and it's very time consuming and sometimes it's depressing, as you say. And it would be great if you could change the system so we don't have to fight so hard. I think that's what we need to do. And I think that's what we are doing to an extent. I think it's an iterative process. So my silly thing with the pie charts is like, Maybe I don't have that much effect, but if we get a parliament next time which is of a different composition, in which the bullies can't exert so much influence, maybe then we can implement some proper changes. So it's an iterative thing. Does that make sense? I mean, to me, it's incredibly iniquitous that we have a campaign going on at the moment where one party can spend 15 million on billboards to influence us, and the other parties don't have as much money. I mean, anything like. I mean, Green Party has 3 and 6 pence. So they can't put billboards up. So it doesn't make sense to call this democracy. Now, we can't expect the next government to change that, because if the next government is run by a government which has an overall majority, because it doesn't benefit them. All we can do, but if we can get the next government to be dependent on debate, honest debate, then maybe that can happen. Maybe we can get proportional representation. Maybe we can get votes for 16-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, we had by coincidence, we did Radio 5 yesterday morning with Mary McRae, and Brian was saying, you know, politics is, there is a real problem with corruption. And she went absolutely nuts. She was like, politics is not corrupt. It is, you know, this is absolute rubbish. We work really, really hard. And he lives in Malcolm Rifkin's constituency. It was a real, like, you know.
She doesn't read the newspapers, obviously. Yeah.
But there is, I feel like there's a real thing, and maybe you can shed some light on this, having worked in Westminster quite recently, that the people you expect to be on your side from a progressive point of view are the people who really kick you in the face when you say anything.
Also, this is terrible. There's been this real trend of members of the Conservative Party or like Conservative staffers showing up with tape recorders at any event that a Labour person's at. So if there is a Tory recording this, I'm not very senior in the Labour Party at all, but so I'm slightly paranoid about being too critical, but I'm going to be honest.
They wouldn't bother turning up to this, would
no,
they?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. But they turned up at like the... Anyway.
They haven't got the money.
Yeah, they turned up to something in December that I really would, you know, it's like people.
And, okay,
you know,
sorry.
Anyway, that's an aside. That I'm still going to be honest. Westminster is so incredibly insular. You cannot overestimate how little people are concerned with things going on outside of Parliament.
Right.
I would love to give some examples of it, but really people are just concerned with what, with other MPs, with votes, with, you know, lobby, like the amount, I don't think anyone really reads lobby journalists other than MPs and people who work for MPs, you know, but the minutiae of people being like, oh, so-and-so briefed that line, and you're like, really? So I think the issue is, so I think that's where you get the disconnect. Because everyone's just kind of gazing inward, so they don't begin to think of how it might appear to someone else. I don't think that's unique to politics at all. The best example of it for me recently was the Premier League had a massive windfall from broadcasting rights. I don't know if anyone saw that, £5.6 billion. And Richard Scudamore was just like, well, I mean, it's just not our responsibility to pay staff a living wage. That's up to the government. And it was like, £5.6 billion. And the people that clean your grounds shouldn't earn more than minimum wage. And so I think really with all elites, you get this disconnect where they're just in their boardrooms talking to each other just don't even see what it looks like to someone outside. So I think that's part of it.
I've invited three of the Treasury team to come and work experience for a week. They've never had a job. They went straight from good school, good uni, and into Treasury. I'm like, come and get a freaking job.
And what, did they take you up on that?
They have said, what a wonderful idea. Let's just refer that up. I will not give up.
I mean,
come and do work experience.
Do you feel like there's a limit? Did you ever look at your campaign or the thing you're running and think there's a limit to how much I can do with this thing I'm doing and I need an allegiance here or there or what? Fran, you take that.
We're trying to change the way money's created. We're trying to nationalise money creation, which is pretty crazy. I mean, this predates capitalism, right? Like, money has always been created by someone bad, basically.
So you are going to need some allies.
We're probably going to need some allies, but I think you can get a conversation going more easily than you think. And the fact that we get random people from all over the world saying, you know, there's just been an organisation set up in Puerto Rico, somebody else in Thailand, like, I want to set up an organisation. And I think we have tools now, which we've never had before. But yeah, definitely there's, I mean, we're growing, and I'm sure 38 Degrees and some of us and Trillium Fund to come DC are all growing, so it feels like it's good, but I think you kind of continually need to be thinking strategically as well, like how do we actually make change and what's fast enough and that, etc. Heading for a climate change apocalypse. Ah!
Well, we forgot about the climate change apocalypse. Yeah.
Something very quickly. I came here today, you know, looking at the list of people and thinking, I want to get together with all of these people, and that's what we should be doing. Rather than be, you know, David runs a huge organisation, and I have a sort of fledgling organisation. I think we all share a belief that things are wrong and we want to change them. I would love to see us work together more. That's kind of what I would like to see, if it's possible. Do you think so, David? I don't know.
Yes, I do. But I think I would say that the biggest challenge we all have is the biggest resource that I think we have in challenging the kind of intersection of political and business elites and the way that they run the British economy and a lot of the world. The biggest resource we have is a human resource. It's ordinary people and the power and the agency that we have within those systems. And I think there is a coordination challenge between organisations, certainly, and I think that's something that I think civil society has got better at in the UK in the last few years, but I wouldn't say it's the biggest challenge. I think the biggest challenge is a mobilisation and a coordination challenge between people. I still think there are a lot more people who care than are active, and communicating outwards to those people, having conversations with them, thinking about the stories we can tell that will inspire them, the tactics we can propose that will motivate them to take part, to make that. I think the biggest transformation at the kind of individual level is that transformation from doing nothing to doing something. From thinking of yourself as someone decisions are made about, things are done to someone who has some agency in that. And that, you know, there's very little in our education system, in everyday life, in people's experience in workplaces, in their experience in education, that gives them a sense of that agency. Mm. So I think those of us that are active, are engaged, thinking about how we can make that case, can inspire that shift is the... And then how, once people have been inspired, how we involve them, how we coordinate them, enable them to connect with people, that's the biggest challenge of all, I think. I think having different organisations trying that in different ways, at times pursuing approaches that don't feel totally coherent and in some ways are contradictory and stuff like that, kind of me is part of a healthy ecosystem. I wouldn't want all organisations to try and like do the same thing. But there's a looser, more fertile form of collaboration, I think, that's more healthy.
Get off your backside, party.
I mean, I've found a lot when I interview people that nobody wants to be called an activist anymore. They actually actively disavow. Oh, the last activist standing. And, you know, in some senses, that's a kind of, you know, if I'm the activist, then all the people who aren't active are the not activists and they can leave the activities to me. Yeah. But in another, there's another sense that, you know, it's a kind of disavowal of the kind of old left placard waving sense.
I just think there's a role for brands, which we're seeing coming through. I mean, brands are a shorthand for making a decision, right? You just kind of,
are they?
Yeah, so we're around the corner from the grain shed, right? Yeah. And the reason I can go there is everything's sustainable. So they even have fish, but they don't have to go, is the fish line caught? And they're like, what is she asking? What did she say? I have no idea what she's saying. What's she talking about? And I can go in there and they have curated for me food that I know is local and seasonal. It's all good and I'll order anything on the menu. I don't have to think about it. So when we grew up, do you remember, you know, in the olden days, we had a wooden TV and there were only three channels on my TV and there was only one ITV and Persil said it washes whiter and then it said Persil washes whiter and we just went, Persil washes whiter, so I'll buy some of that then because it'll wash white. And part of what the change has happened, even in, I'm going to look at myself now, my generation, is that we've had this massive spread out of media into so many different channels. We've had interactive coming through. We've got a generation of people who don't believe what they're told on TV. Mm-hmm. But I still think there's going to be a role, and whether you call that a Brian May brand or a 38 Degree brand, there's an element of a shortcut because we don't have the brain space to make every single decision in all its depth. Uh-huh. And I think the issue for me with politics, sorry, Zoe, that I don't trust the politicians, but I don't trust the media. And I'm freaking, well, I'm like, who do I believe here exactly? Because who am I going to trust,
mind that.
You know?
Of course. No, of course. Don't trust anybody apart from me.
Right, literally. Somebody write that down. In Zoe we trust is a whole new hashtag coming through. But I think that there are potentially a new generation of brands or leaders that give us that kind of steer and shortcut. And in reality, we need them.
Yeah.
People are busy getting on with their lives, pulling the money and feeding the kids. And, you know, they don't even have time to come here and sit and do this. So.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that's something that comes out in from what you've written. I haven't read your whole book, so I don't want to say in your book.
Don't worry about it.
I think that's the biggest challenge to me is that this stuff takes time and takes energy. Yeah. And if you work a 40-hour week, which probably a lot of people in this room do, and then you have kids and maybe you have financial commitments, like a danger for me, which is why I was so inspired by the Focus E15 campaign, is that a lot of the people that bear the brunt of this crap economic system and political system that ignores all but a few interests don't have the time to be really active in the campaigns to change it. And I don't have any answers for that. I'm just putting it out there as another problem.
But then, I mean, and I think the other challenge is that what all ring alarm bells, certainly with old school lefties, that I, as I remember them, is as soon as you start characterising people as either shareholders or consumers, or you're kind of characterising people in their political identity in this very kind of financial pecking order, right? And what do you do if you don't have shares? And what do you do if you can't consume? And where's your identity if you're not spending money? And that is problematic. You can't build a movement only with people who have either spare time or spare money.
No, but I think what you can do is be. I think if you locate it in values and you locate it in a common purpose, then you just pragmatically share whatever you've got, but without that being presented as a hierarchy. So 38 Degrees, we talk about participants in 38 Degrees as members, which winds some politicians up, say, because they say, well, they don't pay a monthly subscription fee, yet you call them a member. They're not comparable to a member of a political party. And they're quite right. They're not comparable to a member of a political party in that sense. But it's very important to the ethos of the organisation that everyone who participates is referred to as a member, because what that means in terms of, say, the culture of the staff team is everyone's opinion counts, everyone's contribution, their agency counts. We have members who give monthly by direct debit. We have members who donate occasionally. We have members who do a lot of in real life organising, a part of the local 38 Degrees groups. And we have members who sign a petition once every couple of months. And those things are all different, and they're all different contributions. But the thing is, the overall impact is the sum of all those different things. And if you start introducing, and you can't kind of equate someone's contribution according to one scale. I mean, the donations that move me the most and operate as the biggest jolt to me of the responsibility we have to our members are the pound coins taped to the back of a note from usually from a pensioner apologising that they can't give more. Like that's a donation that really, you know, says I'm making a full contribution. The danger would be if you say, well, it's the people with the most shares or the biggest, they get invited to special events or those kind of things, which is, you know, exactly how a political party works, isn't it?
I guess, yeah.
Definitely. Right, yeah, that's from Dispatches episodes. I've never been a member of one.
The fascinating with the crowdfunding thing for me is this democratisation of finance. And it can be, it goes down to £5, whatever you want to put in. But if you're the person who's raising the money, if anybody's been to a bank to try to get a loan, it's a really heartbreakingly difficult position. They don't want to give you the money. They won't say no, they won't say yes. They just won't decide, and you're in a small business desperately trying to grow. You want to hire one more person or buy a piece of kit or get some stock in and, you know, actually get somewhere because you're killing yourself trying to get a business off the ground. So it's very, very, very disheartening when the bank just won't even decide and just keep meeting you. And then suddenly you raise the money through a crowdfunding campaign and you no chance of sleeping while that is going on because you're sitting there watching the money. And it is, it's the tiniest amounts of money come in with the little notes. And yes, people are coming in doing financial backing, but they want you to succeed. And you get the most incredible messages and the hairs up on the back of your neck. And then you feel you owe so much to those people because they backed you with their energy, not just their money as well. And that really changes how you feel about the business.
So in a way, that kind of model, that's going back to a very kind of late 1800s way of doing things and the kind of late 1800s way of creating, building societies and creating housing stock and changing. Do you think we're kind of getting to that point again?
But the problem is we have only went off the rails a very short period of time ago, right? I mean, it's literally a few generations in my view. I mean, so when we were young, you didn't have like a Tupperware for your sandwiches. Nobody bought Tupperware for sandwiches. You got your old Flora tub, didn't you? And you put the sandwiches in the Flora tub and you put elastic band around it.
Yeah.
You didn't waste anything.
Yeah.
So I wasn't quite born after the war, but my parents certainly were. But I was still around in the days when you saved up for things and you didn't waste things, and which was very different. It's gone so rapidly off the rails in the last 30 years. I feel it's just really accelerated the problem. And I think, tell me if I'm wrong, I'm probably wrong, but I thought when I was young, there was a little pile of gold beside my money in the bank. I'm sure that's what somebody taught me in the 70s, stopped connecting the money with the gold.
We went off the gold standard, but there's never actual gold for
you. You weren't alive in the gold standard, was she? I don't think she was.
I just look great for 85.
No, but that's what you're describing is a kind of system disintegrating because people aren't frugal enough, which I don't really agree with.
Okay, but I don't think we were as disengaged. I think, you know, I was brought up that it was abhorrent if you didn't use your vote. We didn't waste things. We didn't have lack of delayed gratification. There's some fairly major societal changes that are going
on. Weren't people more engaged with politics because politics made a bigger promise? Politics made a bigger offer. Whereas now politics can't even offer really basic things like your job will cover your rent. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty fundamental, right?
Is it all about money?
Well, it is if you can't afford anything. We seem to be talking only
about, do we not care about a compassionate society?
Yeah.
Seems to be, I find myself getting so depressed because I thought we were going to talk about issues of human values and morality and how we treat each other and how we treat animals. My problem with the way the system works is there is no consideration for anything except money.
I had
a leaflet through my door from the Conservative Party with tick, 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 you know, we took the deficit down, we did, you know, there's nothing that isn't money there. Mm-hmm. And that depresses me hugely because I think our society should be based on morality.
Yeah.
Does anybody...
No, you're absolutely right. I think in a way we get mired in the money conversation because the way money is, the way kind of growthism is the goal now.
And why? Why do we need to grow?
Well, because of the system of money creation, that if you're going to create money out of nowhere, that you then have to grow in order to pay it back.
Growth is what's killing the planet.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And yet we all think we should be growing.
I think the left, in its broadest possible terms, can kind of fall into two traps and needs to fall into neither. One is to get very bogged down in kind of conversations about the financing of things that don't speak to other values, or to do this kind of post-materialist thing that kind of just talks about the health benefits of organic food and animal welfare and things like that, and doesn't relate them back to most people's experiences of a modern workplace or food banks or things like that.
Yeah.
And both of those are equally unhelpful traps to fall into. I think that it's important you do think about like the material conditions that affect people and the fact that, you know, there's a certain amount of luxury to be able to forget those things and talk about, you know, political reform and all these kind of other more abstract things. But there's clearly a relationship between the two. And I think values of exactly the kind that you're mentioning are the link between the two. And you can end up having quite an actuarial conversation or an incredibly metaphysical conversation. And, you know, something a bit more bread and butter would fit in between the two.
Yeah, I mean, Karis, we've actually spoken a lot about how to get values back into... How to kind of establish a set of values as an answer to the neoliberal values. We didn't ever get anywhere, as far as I can remember.
We always
had this conversation that the neoliberal kind of consensus was this kind of small state, low taxes, personal freedom, high defence, and the fifth one that I can never remember.
anyway. There are five. But you can't actually, all answers within that spectrum come back to one of those things. And that's what, you know, you need, you need austerity because you need a small state. You need low taxes because you need a small state. You know, everything comes back to one of these kind of five pillars. And the left never had one of those pillars, had those pillars. And you can't just answer them with their opposite. You can't say we just want a large state and high taxes and no freedom and shit defence. But it does come back to your point that the left finds it very, very difficult to articulate a set of values, and without them just finds itself critiquing an existing world order.
And that's why we like the decency word and the fairness word. I mean, surely some of those are the terms.
The Green Party manifesto has done a fairly good job of being positive. Yeah. I don't regard that as destructive.
Are all the Green Party MPs in your, or PPCs in your commonly decent list?
No, we haven't promised to back all the Green Party, no.
Okay.
We're backing...
You're backing them on a case-by-case basis?
Caroline Lucas and a guy in Bristol, in West Bristol. No, because we consider each case on its own merits. And I think our aim really is to get a good diversity, because from a diversity will come an opportunity for the independents to get in.
Right.
And you know, I don't think, you know, you're not going to get more than a couple of Green candidates in this election, probably, no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. But if you get a decent parliament and you reform the electoral system, then maybe in the future you do. So, yeah.
Is there an opportunity in that kind of position, do you think? Because we don't have one strong party, or any different from...
Well, as I say, I think it's an iterative process. I think you try to get a different composition in the House of Parliament first, and then you get your reform inside and outside Parliament and the House of Lords and everything.
Does anybody think that that whole system of, like, choosing your representative and divesting all your decisions to them for 5 years is bust?
It definitely was conceived at a time when the best technology available was a horse on which to put your MP and send them, your obviously male MP, and send them down to Westminster. I think I'm not someone who believes that you can kind of replace the Parliament with Twitter
I'd love it if we could do that.
Awful, wouldn't it? Yeah. But digital technology means that nothing about our current system is any longer relevant. But I do think there's probably, you know, cultural change coupled with technological change would enable quite a significant overhaul. And there are some other interesting initiatives, I think, bubbling up at this election, like the My Stroud MP initiative, which seems to have spread to a few other places. Yep. They're asking candidates to sign a series of pledges, essentially around kind of elements of direct democracy into how they will conduct themselves as an MP. So undertaking to consult their constituents before deciding how to vote, to be more transparent about how they're deciding how to vote. And, you know, to me, like, to MP... So one MP, a Conservative MP called Tracy Crouch, I singled her out as an example of an MP behaving in a good way on this, when
she's one of yours.
I mean, I think these kind of attitudes totally cross party lines. They're just
there's
a very small minority of MPs in any party who are progressive on these kind of questions. But she, before the vote on a military action in Syria, she emailed all the constituents for whom she had an email address, basically saying, look, I've got this big, it's a war or peace decision. Definitely didn't put anything in my manifesto about how I was planning to vote on this one. Here's how I'm currently inclined to vote. But I undertake to read anything that anyone sends me and think carefully before making my decision, and I'll report back to you on what I did. And the level of positive feedback that 38 Degrees members kind of gave us, you know, people kind of forwarding that into the office saying, if only MPs were like this more often. So I was giving evidence to a select committee about MPs' attitudes, and offered her as an example of and kind of an exception that proves the rule. And she told me afterwards that she'd got a hell of a lot of stick off her colleagues for me having publicised that she'd done this, that MPs saw this as an incredible threat that we are the MPs, we make these decisions, we know how to do this. But I think, you know, there's some relatively modest, both technologically and in terms of changes, that attitudinal changes that representatives could make that would make a hell of a difference to public trust, and I think probably lead to significantly better decision making as well.
I mean, Karis, do you think that's enough to make it more participatory? Just more kind of consultation using. A, do you think that's realistic, and do you think they'll ever do it? And B, do you think it will make enough of a difference?
I'm with the, like, just tear it down. We shouldn't have even been in that awful old room.
Oh, my God, Russell Brand's in the room.
No, you know, we just, like, has anyone been to Holyrood? They have, like, a nice modern round room where everyone's not sat two sword lengths apart from each other.
Or the Welsh Assembly, they've got beanbags.
Yeah. I'm with the beanbag.
Sounds like
Google. I'm with the beanbag brigade. I'm not of the, like, Russell Brand, no one vote. I'm more of the, like, let's get some beanbags going on and, like, less of the wood panels. But I think that the problem with MPs at the moment is they're sort of doing two jobs not very well. So they're on the one hand meant to be a representative of a constituency. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're a member of a political party, and the party system is so strong in the UK that, like, it's just, you know, honestly, if you you don't you know, they don't know half the things they're voting on. That's not a single, you know, they wander into the chamber. Caroline Lucas has written about this really interestingly, because she obviously wasn't part of a party that had a whip, and, you know, she got to look at the votes and decide where she'd be. You know, most of them are really heavily controlled. And so then I wonder how that can be easily reconciled with doing what their constituents would like them to do when they won't have a career or a job, or if they're a minister or a shadow minister, you know, their vote isn't.
There's huge pressure on them to be that way, even if they go in with good impressions.
Well, exactly, and you could get your commonly decent MPs in, and they might just be crunched under the machine.
I mean, Tracy Crouch is a great example. I mean, to finish your story, she did vote against going to war with Syria, and thank God we could have gone to war with Syria. You know, I mean, I think William Hague's, you know, pushing for that was outrageous. You know, we could have been in another Vietnam or another Iraq. And Tracy goes, yeah, there's a few good people, and I totally agree with you. They're in all parties. You find people who have that door opened in their brain where they will be an individual and they'll have the courage to vote on how they feel. And the fact that she got it reinforced by going back to her constituents, I think, is the perfect model. I mean, there is a movement to make MPs accountable directly, isn't it? And you can recall an MP if they don't perform according to your wishes. I mean, that's an interesting development as well, I think, which is Zach Goldsmith's thing, isn't it?
I think that's really critical. Like, at the moment, the system just... It's the whole system. It's not about individual MPs being nasty people. There are no accountability mechanisms. Just even that there's a reason that there was such resistance to recall. It's because it would be a chink. It's a chink in the armour.
It's
bust
hard
open
power.
The system.
It's swapping hard power. And I don't think you can rely on just like MPs becoming nicer and more responsible. You need some hard power for voters in there.
I always find it quite depressing when MPs are really nice, because when you think they're awful, then it makes sense. But then when you meet them and they're quite nice, you just think, oh God, this is really
broken.
The Tories
are some of the nicest ones. Open doors for you, all sorts.
And they're kind of
they're just good talkers.
And they seem to want good things. It's just very confusing.
The incentives are. Why do none of us want to do it? Why are none of us standing? Why are you not standing? No, seriously, what makes people want to become an MP and what makes you not want to do it?
By that rationale, they're all nasty. They've all got narcissistic personality disorder.
Well, I have a narcissistic personality. You have a narcissistic personality. And yet we're on the stage.
No, not necessarily. No, some of them genuinely have a calling. Wouldn't you say? Some of them, there are people in there. I think Tracy Crouch is one.
We're going to all end up voting for Tracy Crouch.
Write songs. So, you know, what's my excuse? I do wonder about it. I mean, the very idea of being elected, because it is one of those things. It's just, I think that if you could just get a few more in there that are one of us, that would encourage the ones that are already there.
I couldn't keep saying system, but I think you get good MPs, but everything about how Parliament is structured forces them into a certain box. And it's the same, I'm going to point at Frank, because we did a lot of work on banking. One of the biggest struggles we had when the LIBOR scandal hit, when I was at the New Economics Foundation, was saying, like, this isn't about putting bankers in jail. Put those bankers in jail and new bankers will come and do the exact same job, because it's how the companies are structured. And I think it's a similar thing in Westminster, to be honest, no matter how many good ones we get in, until we make big changes to the system.
But the good ones can change the system. That's why I say iterative.
They're not democratic. I mean, that's... like Labour and Conservatives, they're not democratic parties. You can't get policies in from the bottom up. Yeah. They have central, like, you kind of can't get to have a ministerial position without towing the party line. So they're kind of broken parties themselves unless they become more democratic.
I think that severance of I think between the membership and the manifesto is has been massive. But that happened quite a long time ago.
But there is still, I think there is still, I think it does come back to forms of power and forms of power that we have outside those systems. So if you, I don't think there are organisations or movements within the UK that have enough power to challenge those things yet. But I think, I hope that a contribution that 38 Degrees can make is to demonstrate, to at least give a glimpse of what that might look like and the possibility that is there. So, I mean, just as an example, 38 Degrees members crowdfunded a piece of independent research into tax loopholes, looking for to try and move the kind of tax avoidance debate away from a kind of a sense of rage and indignation at the scale of tax avoidance, which is a totally legitimate thing, but can quickly lead to a sense of futility and hopelessness in the sense of, well, there's no point putting tax on people who could afford to pay more because they just won't pay it. And we identified a loophole through that research that we dubbed the Mayfair loophole, a loophole that enables private equity managers to classify income as capital gains and therefore pay a much lower rate of tax. And in lots of cases, classify their first £10 million of income as eligible for an even lower rate of tax than them, which some of them, they kind of come back and say, well, but that's run out. That's only a red herring. That's only on the first £10 million of income. But I think to most ordinary people, that still seems quite significant. Which, anyway, this loophole loses about half a billion, roughly, pounds a year in lost revenue. Now, that was a loophole which was part responsibility for the existence of that loophole is kind of split between the current administration and the previous administration. Key parts of that loophole were brought in by the Labour government when Ed Balls was in the Treasury. Yet, thanks to the efforts of 38 Degrees members and the mobilisation around that loophole, in the Labour manifesto this time, is a pledge to close that loophole. Now, you know, it's not that's not fundamental system change. It's not even the biggest tax loophole out there. But I think it is an example of the capacity that people have if we get organised to shift politicians' positions in ways that, you know, half a billion extra for public services is not that will make a difference to people's lives. So it's like if you times that by 50, maybe then you're talking structural change as well. And I think that's the challenge. How do we scale? How do we get bigger?
You've got to popularise it. You know, I mean, that's what you've got to do. You've got to make something a vote winner, because otherwise they're not going to change anything. And if they look at it, go, oh, we've done our poll and research. Like, if we suddenly do this, we're going to get all these votes. And tactically, I think that's the way to do it. And it doesn't have to be massively worthy and massively earnest and super important. There could be some small things that we can do just to say that little bit matters to me. And, you know, so I worry that we just get a little bit too earnest in our conversations.
Okay, I'm going to go to questions.
I know I'm in the Guardian. No, because it's got to be, you know, look at the audience, you know, not this audience. You're very earnest as well, I mean.
No, you're not earnest. Who wants to ask a question? Ask Julia why she's so rude. John, you go.
What you say.
And then over there, and then there. Okay, so that's a little triangle.
Hello, good evening. Thanks for tonight. I'd just like ask all the panel if they're members of a trade union, and if they believe trade unions are part of the problem, part of the narrow elite, or if trade unions could actually be a force for changing and fixing what we think is broken.
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
Let's take three questions and then answer them all.
I sort of go with the discussion that I'm hearing this evening. I agree that the party political system is rigid. I agree that we've got a Westminster elite that seems to be looking after itself. However, I'm not sure what shape this participative democracy would look like, because the whole electorate is not progressive like the people on this platform. Would we get Jeremy Clarkson reinstated? Would we get an end to immigration? Would we get capital punishment? How do we actually develop a participative democracy that isn't complete anarchy?
Yeah, that's a really good question as well. I'm going to write them down.
I'm going to write them down. I'm going to give it.
Thanks. Hey, more of a contribution than a question, but I had fun this time last week heckling David Cameron with my ukulele and managing to totally upstage his first public opinion.
No.
And a few things. I mean, the first thing is, you know, I was very anonymous at that point, and I went away and actually I sat down and I read through all of the comments in the Daily Mail article about what I'd done, and everybody was like, that was great. And I was like, wow, if there's no trolls in the Daily Mail article, then maybe I should tell them my name. But I'm recording this song. I'm going to try and get it to number one in the charts during the election. And I just want to, A, thank you guys, because every single person on this stage, something you've written or done has inspired me over the last few years. And the next thing I want to say is there was something about the Scottish independence campaign that has changed everything. And it can be summed up in this thing I remember. I'm afraid I can't remember who wrote it. But it was this idea that the way the old guard are fighting us now is like them trying to fire a cannonball at a cloud full of butterflies. And I think sometimes we're right, we're spending too much time wondering how to coordinate that cloud of butterflies. But if we all just keep flapping our wings, actually, I think people power is going to come through. And so, yeah, onwards and upwards. Yeah.
Can you sing like for it. Us, please?
Yeah. Can
Would you like me to give you a little song?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. It was, in truth, improvised on the spot, but I did go and work on some verses. Apologies to anybody who doesn't like the word fuck. Fuck off back to Eton, fuck off back to Eton with all your Eton chums. Tax breaks for the rich, tax breaks for the rich, tax breaks for the rich and for all your Tory chums. Now 0 hour contracts, 0 hour contracts, 0 hour contracts for all your Tory chums, and then you'll fuck off back to Eton, fuck off back to Eton, fuck off back to Eton with all your Eton chums. Frack under the houses, frack under the houses, frack under the houses of all your Tory chums. Then it's dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank, dinner at a food bank for all your Tory chums. Fuck off back to Eton, fuck off back to Eton, fuck off back to Eton with all your Tory chums.
That was great. I could never have predicted that would happen.
It's a bit subtle though, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, who's a member of a union?
I'm a member of a union.
I'm actually a member of a union. Okay, there's not that many. Okay, there's
some. Actually, yeah, I am. I forgot.
You're a co-op.
You're a co-op. Okay.
I'm a commercial witch.
Do you allow unions in your company?
Amongst my six employees, yes, I would allow unions from that point of view. I find it's a very good question. I find it very tricky. I find it very tricky. I think I'm so hugely in favour of employment, and I would totally change politics to make it massively incentivize people to work. I think work, I know I'm a Northern Irish prod and we have a very strong work ethic, but I think that work is so important and vital, and I would do masses to support people in employment and make sure it was well worth their while being there and not worth their while sitting on their backsides at home doing nothing, I have to say. And unions, I've had a different side of experience, if I'm being controversial. I've worked in an airline where the unions have decided not to turn up for work one day and we've all had to go down to the airports and do stuff, and it's crippled companies and ended up losing a lot of jobs for the business. So that's my only experience of unions so far. So at the minute, I'm anti.
Oh, okay.
But you're not in a union.
No. Is there a union for crowdfunders?
No, I just wondered.
I could start one.
You're in an association. I mean, my feeling about unions is that, plainly, without collective pay bargaining, wages have gone down, right? Massively. It isn't working. You know, you can't have 58% of the money going to profit without people struggling. So I think it's, you know, you need, if you can think of a better way for people to get their wages up other than arguing collectively, then I'm all ears. But at the moment, what I think is that, unions need to innovate. They need to be online. You need to be able to join them if you don't necessarily have a proper contract. You need to be able to join them for a while. You need to be able to join them if you don't have a job. You need to be able to, I think a union should be more like kind of the TUC meets 38 degrees, and it's not necessarily so workplace tied.
What she said.
Oh.
But I'm a trade union member, have been since I got my first job. They
are part of the solution, but not if they look exactly like they look now. And that's for someone who, you know, I have close friends that work in unions. I think some of us work closely with trade unions around the world. But yeah, not if they look exactly like they do now. There's an interesting, has anyone heard of Coworker in the States, which is like an online union that's trying to do some of the things you're talking about, organising a bit differently.
What about the ratio between the top salary and the bottom salary? I like that idea that nobody in the company should earn 50 times what somebody else
earns. The pay spine idea, so Will Hutton's idea for that in the public sector was 20 to 1. That failed miserably. I mean, it's a hell of a lot. There's a company in Canada that does a kind of fair pay mark, which is 13 to 1, which is fine.
We did 3 to 1 at 38 degrees, yeah. And that's all right. It's still quite a difference, I mean, to be honest.
Yeah, 20 to 1 is ridiculous.
Yeah, the Economics Foundation does 3 to 1, yeah. Publishes everyone's salaries in a spreadsheet.
Isn't there a guy in the States who said 70,000? There's somebody who put himself on a 70,000 salary, did a study and said that $70,000 is the happiest level, so everyone in the company is getting paid $70,000.
Wow. That's really good.
Yeah.
That's interesting. There's still a disparity between men and women's wages in this country, isn't there? Which has widened in the last 5 years. So
pretty shocking. And I think that's about hours, isn't it? That's about people not being able to get the hours they want, and those are mainly women. I think so.
Yeah, it's a mixture, but also the low-paid sectors
tend to be populated.
Like the undervalued, caring
what
sectors
do you think?
And women overrepresented.
About unions.
Do you think
that's too old school? Do you think the collective pay bargaining is too old school?
I mean, I would like to see cooperatives where everyone gets more direct decision making on their pay and that one, you know, one member, one vote. But also, you need unions as well. I mean, both are needed. Yeah. But, I mean, like you say, there's not been, modernise them and more Frances O'Grady's. She's pretty awesome.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, no, she is.
Just on a money thing. Like they are. It feels like there's economists within them, and they are looking out and saying, you know, we need to change, and we need to start advocating for radical economic policy making. And they still have a massive, they have numbers, and they have the ability to be kind of radical. So yeah,
is that an answer? Are you a member of a union?
Yeah, I am a member of a union. Yeah, I'm a member of the NUJ, but I agree with you. It's quite interesting. I just think that where you work or don't work, or where you can get a job or can't get a job, is such a defining. Part of your identity.
Yeah, totally.
But if you're going to organise around that, then the union is probably the best way to do it. But I do agree it should modernise. Yeah. And that was absolutely a good example of hotel workers, for instance.
Yeah.
It's very hard to unionise.
And
they should be more flexible, have more flexible rules. And if they could get a bit of this collectivism, which I'm kind of skeptical about, but some of its ethos, maybe some of its dynamism online, if they could just maybe back themselves a little bit more into the modern age.
Exactly. If they could get its dynamism, its numbers, and its anonymity, so you could lobby for yourself without having to lose your job. I think that would be good. Okay, anarchy. How do we stop? If we're going to have this great participatory, whatever that word is, how do we stop being swamped by Jeremy Clarkson fans?
Well, that's democracy, isn't it? I mean, democracy ought to take care of that.
I think one of the saddest kind of case studies I've seen recently in the kind of like decline and the values of like the traditional electoral left was seeing loads of Labour MPs trotting out this kind of narrative, which was pushed by Frank Dobson, who's MP round here, isn't he?
Yeah, he's Islington.
Yeah, this is during the campaign that 38 Degrees was supporting in favour of a real recall law that would give voters real power over their MPs. And the narrative that was being pushed by these Labour MPs was that if constituents had power over their MPs, women would have never got the vote, abortion would never have been legalised, homosexuality would still be a criminal offence, all these things. And it was just bollocks. It didn't stack up historically. But also it betrayed from these people who supposedly believe in greater equality, stand for the empowerment of all working people, a fundamentally pretty dark assessment of human nature, a sense that the people, the goodies are people in the elite, and positive change happens in spite of the base instincts of most people. And I thought that was a right-wing view, to be honest. But you know, it's endemic within the Labour Party. I think if you give people more say, then that doesn't, it's not the same as me getting my own way. There'll probably be all kinds of things that happen that lots of 38 Degrees members don't agree with. But what you'd have overall is a more mature conversation, and that people are more good than they are bad, particularly if they're given more agency and more control to make conditions better for everyone. So I think that's... But that does come down partly to a kind of like article of faith. Do you believe in people being more good than bad or more bad than good? And I think that's, you know, I don't know, I would hope, I have a sense that Guardian readers should lean more one way than the other on that.
Do you ever wonder if some people are good and some people are bad? Does that ever go through your head?
No.
Because aren't there people who sort of want to start a 38 Degrees campaign to bring back bear baiting and bullfighting and whatever? Are there? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think 38 Degrees is it's an imperfect case study in how this stuff works. So 38 Degrees members decide what campaigns 38 Degrees run.
They didn't want to reinstate Jeremy Clarkson, for instance, did they?
But nevertheless,
somewhere else there was a petition to reinstate this bully.
I mean, but overall, I think that the thing is, like, overall, through giving everyone a say, we make pretty good decisions about campaigns. And then I lap up all this praise for the strategic acumen of picking a campaign to stop the forest being privatised or whatever. And it wasn't my idea. And I think that's the thing, that by giving a lot of people a genuine say, you end up, they take those decisions seriously and wield that power responsibly.
I think your question was really good because you talked about participative democracy, and there's a really, I'm with David here on this, there's a danger that we say, oh, we have the internet, so now we can just have government by referendum. And I think government, like the difference between just, so A, if you just poll everyone in Britain on what they think, then yes, we would have the death penalty back, we would have maximum salaries capped at like £1 million. Like it would be a mixture of things, some of which left-wing people would love and some of which we would hate. But the real nuts and bolts and grit of democracy that I wish we had more of in the UK is deliberation and participation, is sitting across, like, I don't know if anyone's been involved in like local referenda or any decisions.
Like a citizen jury.
Yeah, or things where you don't just get to say, this is what I think, you have to have a discussion about it and you have to hear where the person's coming from that, you know, doesn't think that, and you actually engage with them rather than shouting at them. And all the very few conversations I've had like that have been ones where I've changed my mind. And also it's very rare that people, a friend of mine's a community organiser and does participatory budgeting. Mm. You know, they have a pot of money for the community and it's in a very deprived community, and they say, how do you want to spend it? And at the end of one of the processes they did, all of the young people ended up saying they wanted the money to go on services for older people. And that wasn't what they came wanting it for, and it didn't benefit them personally. And I guess, yeah, I am an optimist, and I think if we have participation and discussion, then we get better outcomes, certainly than the ones we have now.
Okay.
It's kind of lacking in Parliament as it's turned.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, no, completely.
I think it's almost so important we get the participation that if some things go wrong, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Rather we made the mistake because people got off their backsides and did something about it.
Okay, can I go to another question, or does anybody else want to participate? Can I have that question?
So I was going to ask about participative democracy and what your thoughts were on the impact of the anti-lobbying bill at a time when we're trying to get more people engaged in politics and trying to get more people engaged in what they believe in, be that saving the badgers, which David will attest is one of my big, big things. But equally the fact that we're trying to get, we're saying, the MPs are saying to people, we want you to connect with us and we want you to talk to us about voting for us, but actually if you want to campaign on something that we don't agree with, then actually we're not interested and we're going to curb you on that. So I just wanted to get some sense from the panel as to what they thought the impact had or hadn't been, and maybe we don't know yet.
Yeah. Great. And then there's a guy at the back in a suit.
Okay, which is the mayor of the politics is broken.
Much has been made of the expression that politics is broken, and I suppose implied from that is that politicians are broken as well. With the rise of movements like, fundamentalist religious movements across the globe, and the American Tea Party movement, and various heavily religious movements in the Israeli Knesset, is the future really not with politicians, but with priests and the like?
Very good question.
What a question. And then there was one in the middle. Here, with the grey top on.
Auntie Lobby.
And then we'll take all
this. Hi. My question actually was for Brian. I actually hadn't heard of any of these organisations before I came here, and I was really interested in yours. But I was also quite interested when, halfway through the discussion, you seemed to sort of wish that we were talking more about ethics and morality rather than money. And I've been blown away by how all of these other organisations have been using money for, you know, such great purposes. It seems to be a really positive movement. So my question is, do you think there's a fundamental disconnect between money and ethics? And if so, how would you rather frame the argument?
Brilliant question. Okay, everybody, that was a good
question.
Shall
we come
questions.
And sit down there? And
everybody.
Let them come up
with it. Good. Okay, do lobbying first. Who wants to do that? You all must know a lot about this.
David.
So the Lobbying Act was a piece of legislation that this government pushed through last year, purportedly to curb the power of corporate lobbyists, so it only introduced regulations for about 1% of them. The main thing that it did was introduce very significant spending restrictions on the activity of independent campaign groups in the year before an election. 38 Degrees was... a few politicians have off the record acknowledged that we were one of the targets of it.
Really?
But,
yeah, they were. I didn't know that.
But
and
the
US.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, really?
I think the other obvious target was the National Union of Students weren't wishing to limit the amount their ability to talk about broken promises on tuition fees. It's definitely had an impact on 38 Degrees. I think before we do any campaigning at the moment, we're having to check it all with lawyers and have very tight budgets on what we're able to spend on things that are caught by the Lobbying Act. I don't think it's all been negative, actually. In the sense that one of the things I think it's really forced us to do is think about how we can do stuff without spending money. And one of the key ways that we can do stuff without spending money is by empowering our members to do it. And I'm kind of urging them not to keep their receipts, I guess. But you know what I mean. Just there's the one thing that isn't restricted is that kind of people power in its purest form. And I think that has helped accelerate a process within 38 Degrees of decentralization and an emphasis on empowerment, which was kind of core to us anyway, but it's given it that extra impetus. But it's definitely hugely restricted what 38 Degrees is able to do during this election. Our members are very clear they don't want to back a particular political party or campaign to get a particular person elected, but what we do want to do is be talking about the issues that our members care about: tax dodging, the NHS, the TTIP trade deal, health and social care, those kind of issues. And within this audience, even those of you that are 38 Degrees members, you've had quite an asymmetric experience. If you're in a marginal constituency, you're probably hearing from us a lot more than if you're not, because we've had to really carefully focus where, you know, with our members voted for us to do this, but to focus our limited resources that we're allowed to spend during this election on empowering members, giving them things to do, actions to participate in within marginal constituencies. And that means for quite a lot of the country, we've gone very quiet. I think that's a sensible, pragmatic response to this situation, but it also reinforces and perpetuates some of the things that Brian's talking about in terms of a bolder vision.
Of course.
I think I'm aware of lots of other organisations that have simply decided, particularly smaller organisations or organisations with more nervous trustees, who've just decided that it's not worth, you know, 38 Degrees is lucky, we can afford lawyers. Our members have donated to pay for us to get good legal advice and as much of it as we need to take decisions which hopefully keep us out of trouble, though, okay. You know, we're still open to challenge. But I know a lot of organisations have decided we just can't go there, we can't afford the risk of an investigation, so they've just basically stopped campaigning, which is appalling.
And is that everybody else's experience of kind of self-censorship in small organisations? Do you self-censor?
I mean, I don't really know, basically. We've done some stuff around the election, but we're not big enough really to be targeted. I think what we're trying to do is not show any favouritism to any parties.
By
talking about all of them. But basically, I think you have to have a certain amount before you get... targeted, well, right?
The key distinction, it's not about showing favouritism to a party, it's about highlighting an issue where the parties may disagree. So say if you talk about not wanting to privatise the NHS, and some parties want to privatise the NHS and some don't, and you promote a view, you promote the view that the NHS shouldn't be privatised.
Like, we're probably in breach of it.
I think hiring lawyers is an important thing. Some NGOs have decided to, you know, commit an act of civil disobedience, but they are also... Well, that, okay, I'm not going to name them because I'm not 100%, but they are
so
also
paranoid.
People. No, I'm just not sure if they actually did it in the end, but quite a few NGOs like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth were talking about just not complying, but they also can afford lawyers
to then fight
it in court. Okay. And some of the bigger NGOs are saying, we think we can judicially review this. Mm-hmm. So a bad thing and a good thing about the Lobbying Act, bad thing, like, this is part of, and I don't want to make it party political, but this is part of just one of many things that this last government did to just curtail freedom of speech, like judicial review changes. Generally, there's been a real hostility to the charity sector, not just the Lobbying Act.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really strong, specifically Tory mentality that, like, the whole charitable sector is just stocked full of Labour Party members trying to get one. So, you know, you have the Trussell Trust, who are running food banks, are just, you know, agents of the Labour Party. You know, they're saying all these people are starving, but we know what this is really about. You've got, you know, people from the Department of Work and Pensions effectively threatening the Trussell Trust, saying, stop speaking out or we will close you down. So there's, like, a real hostility to just opposition. And I'm not saying that Labour will be better, but I think that's been one of the really nasty features of this government. A good thing, though, is that 38 Degrees is mobilising around the Lobbying Act is a really good example of how people mobilising can... It definitely meant that the Labour Party committed to repealing the Lobbying Act. And also, just anecdotally, a number of MPs just hadn't seen that level of engagement on issues.
Yeah.
So they were like, maybe I should meet all of these people that have got in touch with me about an issue.
Okay, I want to move on to the religion question because we're running out of time. Julia.
Oh, of all the people to ask.
Well, you're a proddy.
No, I think it's really interesting. I think there's something about the second half of life, which probably applies to quite a few of us in this room. There's sort of you need 7 hours to go through this. But I worry a lot about the fundamental groups and where they're coming from. But I in some ways feel like I can understand why people are reaching out for that, because of family and the challenges of family and the lack of older generations. I'm a massive fan of elders, and I think there's not enough of them around. So in some ways, I would equate the religion to the brand. It's just there's an idea that there's something that we can be part of. I think it's a fairly lonely existence for anybody who's trying to change anything or swim against the stream or do anything different, whatever stage you're doing it at, and you need other people to do it with. And I think that potentially is part of the draw of a religion, is that there's a purpose and there's something which you're trying to achieve, or you believe in, and you do it together. So there's a positive and a negative there, I guess.
I think it leads into the point, Brian, about values and money, because maybe the rise of it is to do with the fact that politics doesn't really talk about values, and that's what people want to listen to. But if you could then take the question about, you know, how you talk about values, if it's not, you know, in a way that you don't feel is contaminated.
Which brings us to your question. Yeah, I mean, strangely enough, I was having a conversation with Anne, who's my CEO, in the car, and we came to the conclusion that there's a difference between being impassioned about something and that passion leading to you making money. And the money is kind of a signature that perhaps you're doing it right. And Freddie was the first one to say, you know, yes, I'm proud of my money because it shows that people like what I do.
Yeah.
There's a difference between that and your passion being money.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think it all goes wrong. You know, and I think if we're talking nuts and bolts, you know, I think there's a strong case for taxing businesses which don't have any benefit to the community incredibly heavily. You know, I mean, the whole hedge fund thing, I find... Maybe, I'm naive about money, but I see the hedge fund thing as completely predatory, completely parasitic, and I think they should be taxed out of existence.
Fran, is that the answer? I'll ask you in a second, Julia.
I mean, my answer takes that back. I mean, I think people basically want three things broadly in life, which is security, prosperity, and meaning. And I think the fundamentalist religion stuff out of people searching for meaning and needing something higher and bigger than themselves. And part of the problem with society is that we have decided that money is an end in itself rather than a means to an end. And therefore, if that's the end goal, then clearly there's not much meaning around for people to cling on to. Mm. So then you find people, you know, ending up in these fundamentalist groups, which often can be negative, and other, you know, all people going and joining, doing more mindfulness or Buddhism, which is potentially a good thing. But I think that, yeah, I think that that's a fundamental problem. And I guess one of the things we're trying to do more and more is do a bit of the personal side of things with money, because we do all have a bit of a fucked up relationship with money, partly because we have a society that tells us if you're only successful if you earn this much, and that's the definition of success. And look at those clever bankers in the city, that's why they earn money, because they're so clever, and you're not clever, so you don't earn money. And it's all kind of tangled up. And so you kind of do need to do a bit of unpacking of the personal relationship with money, I think, to order to then get to also, like, what the fuck is money? And it is just trust, and it is a kind of, we all buy into it, and so we all say we'll exchange, you know, bits and pieces for the same money. But it is all founded on trust, essentially. If we all decided tomorrow we all trust Bitcoin, that's the populist one, then we could all use it, right? But we kind of trust the pound sterling because we kind of trust politicians, and it's all wrapped up together.
Right.
You know, we wouldn't have a pound without a state. Okay, have I gone too far?
I've got it. Okay, we've got time for one more question. No, there's this guy. You can have it because you're so fast.
Okay, this is a how do we fix democracy question.
Yeah.
We've talked about collective action. We've talked about participatory democracy. But those things only get you so far. We can't all be experts on finance, the NHS, on all those things out there. At the end of the day, you need to turn to experts. You need somebody to represent you, somebody who is either an expert or who can go to experts and help get the right decisions made. And the problem is, we have a representative democracy, but that isn't what happens. So my question to you guys is, how do we fix it so that is what happens?
Okay.
In how many characters?
In 140 characters. Brian.
You might have one thing from each of you.
Yeah, okay.
What would you change? What would you want to see manifestos?
My answer would be as before, it's iterative. I think you have to change the system, and then the system can change some more. And so I would say one step at a time.
Julia.
I think the problem with money, which is what motivates so many people in so many ways, is that we don't have that transparency. So for me, the key change is that we now have 5.5 million people in the UK who have a little bit of money, who can't get an advisor to tell them what to do, even if they wanted to, because they can't afford it. And I think in that circumstance, we look to our peers. So I think the value, not just of 38 Degrees and other sites, in terms of actually forming an opinion by listening to the conversation. And I would say there's a power of the crowd in doing that. So you've got to form your opinion by getting as many other inputs as you possibly can. So for me, the key difference is that when people are now deciding for themselves where to put their money, even if it's only 50 quid, when they can see where it's going, it'll reconnect those three things you refer to in terms of security, prosperity, and meaning, because your money should be part of your meaning, and you should connect the two together, and then that's where happiness lies.
Fran.
I've forgotten the question.
How do we rebuild democracy?
All right. We need more people getting together in public places and forming relationships about things that they care about. Practical thing, I think we need proportional representation.
Yeah. Okay. Kara?
I'm going to just focus on the Westminster thing. Fran said PR, recall, I'd say term limits.
Term limits for the Prime Minister?
For MPs.
Two
terms? It should be a job for life. Two, three tops.
Okay.
I think those kind of incremental reforms get you somewhere. I'm quite interested in, instead of having an elected House of Lords, drawing it by lots. You'd get lunatics, criminals, all sorts, just like at the moment. But I think that would, which is kind of the opposite of your expert point, really. And I think there is definitely a role for people with specialist knowledge in decision making. I think it's important to be cognizant as you think about that, though, that expertise is often not
as neutral and as dispassionate and
Highly subjective.
Is often highly subjective and often very subject to exactly those same forces of big money as other areas in terms of which experts are popping up and why they're popping up where.
I think, even though I'm the chair and I technically don't have a view, I think we've got to reconnect membership, party membership with manifestos, because that's what Podemos has, that's what the SNP has, basically. That's what every single party that's got a resurgence of membership, it's because the members are listened to in the manifesto. Yeah, well, I think if you were listening to your members, then they would say we want some values, and they would be say these kind of realpolitik verities that you give us, like this can't be solved and this can't be solved. Well, we have to solve it because we can't leave it like it is. So I think that would make a huge difference. But anyway, so on that note, on the note of me not having a view, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. Sorry to keep you so long, everybody. It's 8:20. Thank you to the panel. It's 8:40, sorry. Thank you for being such a great audience. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.